Welcome, listeners, to Connect the Dots. I'm Allison Rose Levy. I'm here with you every week at 10 a.m. on Wednesdays on the Progressive Radio Network. I've been reporting on health, food, the environment, and everything we need to have a healthy community and a healthy lifestyle for the past 25 years, as well as on personal health and integrative medicine. And my goal on every program here in the Connect the Dots series that's been with you here on Progressive Radio Network for over a year and a half is to connect your understanding of what you need for your personal health to what we need for our total health environment. And that means the health of our communities, our society, and the health of our habitat, which is planet Earth. Because even though we kind of like to hold ourselves up and regard ourselves as, world-leading democracy, great big country, strength of our power as individuals to achieve things, if we don't protect the health of our communities, of our society, and our natural habitat, we are nowhere. So every week on Connect the Dots, I bring to you different guests who shed light on important facets of where action can be taken, where new science can be understood, where we can connect the dots between different aspects of the complex world in which we live and what we can do to protect our health, the health of our world, and the health of future generations. So it's my pleasure every week, and we have some really terrific guests. I'll talk a little bit later in the show about some of our archives as well, because we have some terrific programs in archives. I'm very excited about today's guest on our show. He's been with us before and will hopefully be with us many times. He's one of my favorite activists in this country. But before we get right to that, I just wanted to give you a little update. You know that every week on Connect the Dots, I always provide an easy way for listeners to take action in the various public policy matters and initiatives that impact our health and the environment. And so this week I have some good news, because one of the actions that featured repeatedly on the show, and really going back to the show's precursor, over a year and a half ago on, prior iteration of this show, we've been covering the Safer Chemicals Act, because how the chemicals that we use, both in personal products, in cosmetics, in tin cans, in receipts, and that are used in industry, all of these are or should be regulated according to laws and regulatory policies under the Environmental Protection Agency. Otherwise, the chemicals that we assume are tested and vetted by government to make sure they're safe for us and our families, in fact, have never been tested and aren't, and are just freely used, and we're exposed to them in an ongoing and incremental fashion. And that's why I've been a big champion. I've covered it on the Huffington Post, where you can follow my blogs, and had some of the leadership of this repeatedly on Connect the Dots. And that is the Safe Chemicals Act, which was introduced into the Senate by Senator Frank Lautenberg, so that after over 30 years, it's actually since 1975, we could finally begin to update our out-of-date chemical safety laws. And there's been a big battle because the chemical industry and all their allies that use those chemicals, and we'll be discussing those more in the body of the program, they don't want to see them regulated. They don't want to have to make them safe for our use. And so they've been fighting tooth and nail, but we do, all of the Citizen Action and the coalition of over 250 groups that are part of Safer Chemicals Healthy Families, a wonderful organization that we've covered repeatedly here on Connect the Dots, and all the many hundreds of thousands of citizens that are active through that and who are fighting for chemical regulation and safety, they've had a major step forward. And I just want to, I'm always kind of giving you the bad news, so I wanted to give you the good news, that for the first time in 36 years, finally, we've had a vote in Congress to begin to update these laws. And that was when the Safe Chemicals Act passed a committee, a key committee in the Senate. The Senate Environmental and Public Works Committee passed voted on this and pass it forward, it will then be going to the Senate floor and from there to the House. So that doesn't mean the law is passed. It doesn't mean our work is over. But it means that an important step forward has occurred, a step for public safety. I just wanted to celebrate that and also let you know that you can go to online to saferchemicals.org to join the many people who have won this victory and continue to take action to move this legislation forward to the Senate and then to the full Congress so that we can finally get the regulations that we so dearly need. So now, and you'll see also, this is a very relevant celebration for the main theme of today's program, which is we're going to have some very important updates on some national and local activities concerning actions against fracking. And I'm bringing you today, my guest is one of the leadership nationally and in New York State and the Northeast region of the fractivist community, the much admired, hardworking, and always inspiring David Braun, president of United for Action. Welcome to Connect the Dots again, David.
It's great to be here. Thanks so much for having me.
I have been traveling and sort of doing shows from afar for over the last couple of months, and so I haven't done a fracking show very recently, but there's been a lot of new developments, very important new developments. And first, I would love if you could give our listeners an update on last weekend's very important rally in Washington, D.C., Stop the Frack Attack, which occurred on July 28th. Just tell us all about how many people came, what went on there, what all of the people who attended are aiming to achieve.
Sure. Well, it was a multi-day event. I mean, it culminated with a big rally in March with about 5,000 people at the end of the program that they had scheduled for several days. But it involved, some trainings, a lobby day, a strategy session that was broken down not only by state, but also nationally in strategizing. And then had some really great panel speakers. We had Josh Fox there and Bill McKibben and Jane Pratsky, who's the frack man from Australia, was there. And very inspirational time. And the rally day itself was just great. It was on the West Capitol lawn right there in front of the Capitol building. And, again, had some really powerful speakers. And then the march part of it was just fantastic. We marched over to the American Natural Gas Association, and then also followed up with the American Petroleum Institute, which last year spent $20 million to basically spin hydraulic fracturing and make it somehow an acceptable practice in the minds of Americans. So it was very, symbolic and very strong and very good, and I think it was good. The one thing I kept hearing is, for us here in New York, we're fairly well organized, and we have, we're able to offer and share our strength with people in other parts of the state, I think, more readily. For those people in other parts of the country who are in more kind of remote areas, I think it's like three women from Idaho and, some of the folks from Colorado were saying how, they got, their hearts were, filled with love and strength after having this whole experience, and that they can go home to kind of deal with, the nightmare of what they're dealing there in Gasland a lot easier because they feel the support and they know that there's other people out there that understand, and they know that there's other people out there that are going through, these issues of toxicity and having their lives interrupted and, their water poisoned and, et cetera, and unfortunately the health issues. But that gives them strength for them to go back into their communities and feel like they're not the only ones. And I think that that's, people, look at when you want to hold a rally of this magnitude, and you don't, I guess, really consider that that's really what you're doing, but offering a lifeline to those who don't feel maybe secure or comfortable in their communities, especially because of what this industry does to people.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you've seen it, but Simona Perry does these case studies, and she is entitled, It's Like We're Losing Our Love. And you can actually find it on the homepage of United for Action. And she did these case studies over a number of years in Pennsylvania, and you see what happens to these communities. It's that the communities start out, and everyone's like, hooray, the frackers are here, and, you know, they're kind of focused on the financial or the economic aspects of it. And then over time, you hear the grumblings of, oh, there's a lot of truck traffic, and, oh, there's a lot of air pollution, and then you start hearing the, oh, my water's been poisoned, and then, but the thing that we see that happens in these communities the most, and this is what we've seen with, say, the families in Dimmock, Pennsylvania, is that the people who are the victims are then somehow turned into, in the eyes of the community, the perpetrators.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason that is because they're essentially cutting off the gravy train by speaking up and saying, hey, this is really damaging. Hey, my water's been poisoned. Hey, I'm having health effects. I'm getting sick in the morning. My kids are having nosebleeds. I passed out in the shower. I'm having intestinal infections that are breaking through my skin. My gallbladder's been removed. All of these things. And that is getting, it's an obstruction for the people who want to see this drilling happen, who are financially benefiting from this. And so what happens in these communities is they turn against these people, and it creates literally like a civil war in the communities. And the people who are really been victimized in the situation are then somehow viewed and spun around to be the perpetrators. And I think it's great that we were able to support those and give some strength to those folks who've unfortunately been put in that terribly unjust situation, and that we're able to kind of send them back into their communities with a little more strength and maybe a little more hope. So I think it was a really successful event. And I think it's the ultimate also just being an American, standing by those who, have been unjustly treated, and, and letting them know that they're not alone.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting, David, because we've talked about this issue many times, but I'm really interested to hear you bring up the word victim, because
yeah.
I think it's really important to, mention this, because many in the health-oriented community whom I've addressed for, two decades or more, also do spiritual practice. They do some form of stress management or meditation or something and regard themselves as spiritual. And yet the sense is if somebody, because of their birth status and educational opportunity or, for some other reasons, winds up in a community where this is happening, it's basically there in a sense, if people that are not in that situation just want to kind of shun them and make the problem go away, they really don't want to look at this or the fact that they themselves, may be using the products that are then creating the need for this. I mean, nobody really wants to change very much, and so it's very frequent, and everyone is desperate to survive and succeed and be a winner in a very uncaring society that, with these powerful economic drivers that make it really hard for people to succeed at a kind of normal human level. It becomes a sort of superhuman thing, and in every direction we have people marketing and selling themselves and selling everything because it's such a, underneath the surface of the smiles, there's such a battle to survive. And so if we see people who we want to characterize as victims or, who are getting the unjust end of the stick in some kind of way, in order to protect our own sense of security and feel safe, we kind of want to put them in a different category and push them away from ourselves rather than what you're doing, what you're modeling, which is really the essence of both democracy and really a higher and more compassionate form of justice and spirituality. which is to go toward, to embrace, to take care of, to say, thy battle is mine, that kind of thing, rather than merely to dwell in one's own comfort and hope that one can survive as things get progressively undermined in terms of our environment and our democracy. So, you know, I really, you know, salute you for that. But I think, you know, in a certain way, it's also important to talk about it and to be conscious of it and to really, you know, each of us, and I say this to the listeners, to ask ourselves where we stand. If you're in a position where you don't have to worry, then you're in a position where you can afford to worry and care about others. Now, it's been said by some, I just read something on Facebook where a University of Penn official said something to the effect of, well, some areas will just be sacrificed. The state of Pennsylvania will be a sacrifice. Now we have fracking potentially coming to areas of New York, you know, looks very imminent, and I'd like you to update us on that. And it's, but first, let's just, you know, is it okay to sacrifice people, communities, when there are good alternatives? You know, what does that say about us as a country?
Well, I mean, what is, I think what it really says is that we have drank the Kool-Aid. Mm-hmm. That we have somehow accepted that that there has to be a certain amount of acceptable losses in order for us to power our lives. Mm-hmm. And I don't buy that, and I think there's a good many people who don't believe that this is true. But unfortunately, somehow our energy policy has been switched around with, like, our policy in the military. So when an army goes to war, they have a certain goal that they want to achieve, and they're willing to accept a certain amount of acceptable losses at a time of war so that they can achieve their success, so they can achieve their goal. And so they'll say, okay, for, you know, we'll put 100,000 people on the battlefield, and we'll accept 5,000 of those people die, or whatever it is. And somehow we confuse that for our energy policy, thinking that this is, you know, I mean, to have Terry and Gelder come out and say, you know, well, that's it, sacrifice. Mm-hmm. You know, this is absolutely absurd. You know, there are people in this world, scientists, you know, people that are experts in renewable energy, Mark DeLucci from Stanford, or Mark Jacobson, I'm sorry, and Mark DeLucci from, what was the other, you know, another UC campus out there in California, have, you know, they wrote the paper back in 2009 that was in Scientific American that said we can be 100% on renewables in 20 years. And, you know, we don't, you know, there are issues, I think, with solar and wind, but people are not having their gallbladders removed as a result. People are not having these infections that are breaking through their skin. People are not having their hair fall out and being told by their doctors they can no longer have children. Or, you know, these things just don't happen with solar and wind power. And it's absolutely absurd that we know that this is hurting and killing people. We've seen the evidence. We've seen, you know, Gasland. We've seen Split Estate. We know, we've heard the stories time and time and time again. And somehow there's just rationalization, justification that we need this gas while there's a glut of gas in the market. And I mean, you know, I've talked to you about this before, but the shortest distance between two points is a straight line. If we know that we need to get renewables as our kind of primary energy source, then we need to be doing everything towards that end. And you have the gas industry that comes along and says, oh, no, 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 no. You know, you get to renewables by going to all these other destinations that have absolutely nothing to do with renewables, building out pipelines and, you know, doing this fracking and, you know, building out this infrastructure and completely changing the way that we, you know, are kind of burning or utilizing our energy source. And it's completely the wrong direction. And what's most absurd is that we're actually allowing it to happen. But I think one of the things that, you know, Josh Fox has been talking about most recently is really what's going on, is that they're injecting, the oil and gas industry is just injecting so much money into our political system that they have bought our democracy. And we saw that with Josh getting arrested down in D.C. And we see this time and time again where, you know, you just see blind eyes turned towards things that are really important and critical. You know, we know, and Josh talks about this in his video, The Sky is Pink. And I encourage any of the listeners, if you have not seen the movie, The Sky is Pink, it's an 18-minute short movie that's on the internet. You can just Google The Sky is Pink. And in that movie, he talks about what the industry knows. And he pulls from their own information that in the first year, 5% of all the well casings fail. First year, 5%. That's 1 in 20. Imagine if 1 in 20 airplanes fell out of the sky. We would no longer fly. Imagine if every 1 in 20 times you got into a car, you got into an accident. People would no longer drive. Mm-hmm. It's just, you know, it's absolutely absurd that somehow 1 in 20 is acceptable, and it's because of all this money they injected. In the first 30 years, 50% of the well casings fail. Now, we're dealing with some serious volatile organic compounds, radiation, and then these chemicals, 400,000 pounds of these toxic chemicals per well. And over the course of 30 years, we know that 50% of the well casings are going to fail. This is absolutely absurd. I mean, it's one of those things that you just say, who in their right mind is even allowing this to be considered, let alone be done? Mm-hmm. You know, and then here in New York State, like, there was a delivery of a letter that just went to Governor Cuomo from 250 scientists, doctors, and nurses and medical professionals. And it says to him, you know, we hear you say that you're listening to the science, but we are not being heard. We have submitted reports, testimony, information, time and time and time again, and we hear nothing back. You know, they feel like they're shouting into a cave, you know, or down into a black hole where nothing comes out of it.
And then, there is no health assessment or anything.
There's no health assessment. But to make things worse, though, there was this environmental working group report that came out about a month ago. Mm-hmm. We found, you know, that so this environmental working group, they foiled the Freedom of Information request for emails between the DEC and the gas industry. Mm-hmm. And what they found was that the DEC had prematurely shared the environmental impact statement, ESGEIS, and proposed regulations with the industry. And when the industry had some objections to what was contained in that document, Steve Russo, who's like the deputy commissioner of the DEC, wrote in an email back to Tom West, who's the lobbyist for Chesapeake. He says, I'll call you first thing in the morning. Now, these scientists are really upset because they keep submitting information and they keep having serious issues and serious misgivings about what's in this document, and never have they heard from the deputy commissioner at the DEC, I'll call you first thing in the morning. Meanwhile, the governor keeps saying he's listening to the science. No. He's not listening to the science. He's listening to the industry. He's listening very well. We can see that based on the actions of his deputy commissioner, his appointee, there within the DEC. They are not following up with the scientists. They're following up with the industry.
So, you know, what does that mean? I just want to interject here as someone who's reported on science extensively, and specifically on, you know, health science and the connection between toxic substances and our health. So when the Department of Environmental Conservation, which is the New York State Department that will oversee whether and how gas fracking happens in New York State, how it's regulated, how it's monitored, what, if any, safety protections are put in place in terms of where it's located or how it's done, and who picks up the tab, if there are costs, health problems, mass contaminations, contamination of the New York City water supply, all of the various things that are at risk. And basically, this is happening despite the protestations about science, as you say, David, without a health assessment, without an environmental assessment. That means that no one is sitting down and saying, what are these chemicals? How much will people be exposed to in the event of a leak, which if it's 20% of the time, or 1 in 20, that's very common. You know, who will pick up the tab? Who is liable? What guarantees do we have for public health? What do scientists say about the, you know, exposures to these and what diseases will result? So the science that's not being done is the science that's basically saying, you know, what is your health risk if this goes forward? And that's not, that's obviously, you know, there's a radius, which is the nearer you are to the center, you know, ground zero, the radius, obviously the more dangerous, intense health impact there is. But that doesn't mean that there is a zero impact, because there are studies that show that this stuff migrates and can affect people from afar through their water, through their food, which we've covered, you know, very often in previous editions of this show. So the science that's not being done, listeners, is a science that would assess your health risk, the health risk to you, to your grandchildren, to your colleagues, to the healthy food you want to eat. That's the science that, you know, the guy, you know, Mr. Russo, as David Braun describes, is on the phone placating industry. He's not on the phone with a scientist saying, what are the ramifications? How can this be studied? How can we make this safe? That's not the call that he's making. And that confers increased health risk to everyone, not just in this state, but in this region, because, you know, this stuff migrates through water, air. It migrates, you know, anywhere at all, really. And that's another thing. Not knowing the environmental piece, we don't know how it migrates, actually. So I just want to interject that, because this is important, life-determining, critical science that isn't being done here.
Yeah, I mean, it's honestly, it's criminal. There is a paper that recently came out of Cornell that has yet to be peer-reviewed, but I believe it's in that process. And what it determined is it studied the gas fields and pregnancy in Pennsylvania. Mm-hmm. And what it actually determined is that mothers who were smokers and gave birth to children actually had healthier babies than those mothers who gave birth to children living in the gas field.
Unbelievable.
I mean,
unbelievable.
It's shocking. It's the worst nightmare that we could possibly wake up to, except that it's one of our choosing. Mm-hmm. It's not like, you know, I mean, a friend of mine says, you know, going to be like the same equivalent of a plague of locusts coming to, you know, attack our crops and our communities and the whole thing. He said, the only difference is with the plague of locusts, we could apply for federal disaster relief. With fracking, we can't even do that. Mm. We're just stuck with it. Mm. Meanwhile, the people are getting, you know, the big landowners will do okay, depending if they're, I mean, you know, 20% of the wells are profitable. 80% aren't. But of those 20%, a lot of those wells do very, very, very well. Mm-hmm. And some of those wells don't. Mm-hmm. So some of these big landowners are going to do really well. We know that the gas industry is going to make off like bandits.
Mm-hmm.
But the rest of us are going to be...
Mm-hmm.
What's that?
Because they'll be selling it abroad where it commands
high
prices.
Sure. I mean, yeah, I mean, that's the intention. There's like four LNG, liquid natural gas, export facilities that have now been green-lighted that are being built around the country. One in Oregon, one down on the Louisiana-Texas border, one, I think, in Maryland. And that's the intention. I mean, Shell has come out and said this. And, you know, we know that, you know, this industry, this fracking, hydraulic fracturing industry, is, you know, basically the big guys have come in. You know, Chevron bought a company called Atlas. BP is now doing fracking. Shell is now doing fracking. Exxon bought XTO and is doing fracking. I mean, this is the oil industry now getting into a new business because they see that the exports are the way that they can go. It's something that they can only sell here for, say, $3. The price is now edging up here in the United States, which I'm sure they're happy about. But something they can only sell for here for $3, they can go and sell in China for $15. Mm. And so this is a big money winner for them. Unfortunately, it's a tragic health crisis for us here, and that's being covered up. I mean, the gas industry is now paying for studies and is influencing. I mean, they're doing everything they can to try and spin this into somehow being an acceptable practice, going after editorial boards and having great success. You know, funneling
going
a lot
after
of money.
Editorial boards? You mean of in the media?
In the media, yeah, and in you know, newspapers to try and sway their opinion and lobbying them and being very, very successful in their lobbying because they then get, they basically are paying off various, you know, professors and researchers and whatnot in schools and funding them very, very well to come out with reports and studies that are preferential to their, you know, to their perspective. But it doesn't stop the stories that we hear come out of Gasland, people
well,
being
you know
poisoned,
what?
people getting sick.
Yeah. Let's talk more about some of those stories after the break. We're going to break here for station identification and also about the influence on academic institutions and the media. That's a subject of great interest because I'm in the media and I've seen that influence firsthand. But right now we'll be taking a break. Please stay with us, listeners, for my conversation with David Braun of United for Action on Connect the Dots, and we'll be with you with the rest of the conversation after the break. Welcome back, listeners, to Connect the Dots. I'm Allison Rose Levy, back with you for the second half of our show. Here with you every Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network, bringing you a whole range of different facets of our complex world and how they impact our health, the health of our communities, the health of our society, and the health of planet Earth. Returning with me is today's guest. We've been having a really terrific conversation. He's David Braun, the president of United for Action and an environmental leader through his protection of water, food, and air here in the Northeast region from fracking, the gas drilling practice that uses over 500 toxic chemicals and is poised to, sadly, enter New York State, which is what we were discussing in the earlier part of the show, despite the fact of ample public feedback and concern by scientists about the health impacts. Before we broke, for our station identification, David was saying that the gas companies, the oil industry, which is really the, you know, buying up these smaller companies and really the power behind the throne, so to speak, and taking over and seeing this as their next bonanza, despite its cost to people, health, and communities, has really been spending a lot of money on PR and marketing to influence the media. I'd like to talk about that a little bit, having been in the media for a couple of decades and seen that kind of thing going on behind the scenes. I was at CBS as a producing editor for a number of years, at PBS, and have worked in a bunch of other outlets. You know, there are a lot of things in our world that we like to think of as objective, the media, science, the government's there to protect us and all of that, and yet a lot of these major infrastructures have been corrupted. This is actually the subject of the book that I am currently completing. So I'm always interested when we get into these conversations. What can you tell us about media influence by the gas and oil industries to make us believe and make reporters report that, you know, fracking is needed, good for us, and okay.
Yeah, well, it's been, I mean, a real campaign that we've seen information come out recently that essentially the industry launched a campaign to lobby editorial boards utilizing information that they had basically paid through, for instance, say like the University of Buffalo to create. So it's this very concerted campaign of PR spin where they just throw a lot of money into it and are interested in simply just swaying public opinion by essentially buying experts, in this case the University of Buffalo, and then using that information that they've essentially purchased to then spin, you know, editorial boards and put that information out into the press as if it were true.
Mm-hmm.
And it just, you know, again, I think one of the things that it does is it does basically what, you know, Josh Fox's, you know, short film The Sky is Pink talks about, is that you can have one person coming out who's an independent scientist that can say, you know, we have this information. This information that we have here is true, and, you know, we know that this is going on. And then all you have to do is have one person that is has some qualifications, irrespective of whether the reporter or whoever it is that may be covering the story or trying to develop an opinion on the story, actually investigates whether that expert is on the dole, you know, it's a shill for the gas industry. But irrespective of, you know, checking to see the whether that expert's opinion is tainted by money in any way, they report both facts, you know, both as facts, I suppose. And so then that creates doubt. And so then they can say, well, you know, the facts are still being debated because we have, you know, one expert on this side, of course, who's independent. He's not taking any money from the gas industry and, you know, just trying to protect his children or whatever it is. And then you have the other one who's taking money from the gas industry and his voice has been tainted. Unfortunately, the papers are press coverage. I think a lot of it is because maybe the press outlets don't have the money that they used to have to really cover and dig into a story. And so a lot of reporting just becomes dueling PR statements. You know, one PR firm spits out one thing, one PR firm spits out another, and, you know, the people that are reporting the issues or, you know, the facts basically just start make it easy on themselves, saying, well, this person says this and this person says that, and they just take quotes from each, and then all of a sudden there's a story. And story is...
Yeah, that's called tit-for-tat reporting.
Tit-for-tat reporting, and unfortunately what we end up with is we don't get to the bottom of anything. It's just another kind of veil or confusion, and meanwhile the industry gets to kind of proceed with what it wants to do because they hide behind other things. You know, it's an interesting thing. We're talking about health and we're talking about, which is a major concern, but they're using this economic argument to push this whole debacle forward. Mm-hmm. And the funny thing with all of this is, you know, their numbers are all wrong. I mean, Jeanette Barth, who's an economist and has studied this considerably, you know, uncovered that they said in 1 year, the gas industry said that they created 80,000 jobs in the state of Pennsylvania. And she went through and really thoroughly reviewed, you know, the numbers and tried to check everything out from like five different sources. And her conclusion she came to is they actually created 6,600 jobs over the course of 3 years. Now, one of the interesting things that they've done here in New York State is they have very specific job numbers that they took directly from the industry, they being the DEC and their supplemental generic environmental impact statement. But one of the things that they didn't, as well as the health impact, without, you know, really truly assessing some of these other things that we've been talking about, they also did no job losses report. They didn't include what's going to happen to the tourism industry. I mean, honestly, who's going to want to go tour around the Finger Lakes when they're having to, you know, duke it out with large, heavy diesel Mack trucks, you know, tearing up the roads? Or all the ground level ozone that's going to be created from, you know, these drilling operations, right? We know that, you know, the air quality in Wyoming last year was worse than the air quality in Los Angeles. Here, this is a place that has one person per capita per square mile. The air quality is worse. I mean, that's not a place where I would want to take my family to vacation. They're not considering what's going to happen to the wineries. Or, you know, we have Omegang Brewery in Cooperstown says that they're going to leave the state if fracking comes. We, you know, I mean, there's countless other industries that are existing that they're not considering, that are the bedrock and the fabric of our communities, you know, and this is our farmers. I mean, there's a chef from Gramercy Tavern has a farmer that's looking at property right now in New Jersey because he can no longer grow his vegetables in New York, if gas drilling comes. He doesn't want to grow his vegetables in the gas fields. And I'm glad he's going to do it. But, you know, I mean, aside from the fact that we're going to start to get these tainted vegetables or whatever in our farmers markets, which is absolutely terrifying, what's it also meaning to our economy? And these are all things that, you know, aren't being discussed or aren't being considered. And it's, again, it's uprooting our communities. It's uprooting the fabric of our economy as well. And, you know, these things aren't being considered and aren't being discussed and aren't even being included in the documents that are being prepared that supposedly are examining this whole issue.
It's like what goes around comes around. So, you know, it may start in one location, but it may, you know, all too quickly come around to other locations. And I think that's, you know, so there's a temporary feeling of exemption if you're, you know, a certain distance away. But ultimately, it's, you know, it's going to be coming around through the various forms that you mentioned. Let's just talk a little bit about what people can do. First of all, I want to refer our listeners to your website, unitedforaction.org. Any events, any initiatives, calling Governor Cuomo, all of that is something they can find there, yes?
Yeah. So before I jump into that, I did want to mention that a couple of things just in the last points, the things that I was talking about, that we've actually seen the business community come out now against fracking. And so just this past week, in conjunction with New Yorkers Against Fracking, which is a group that I've been working with, which is a coalition of about 162 groups, I think we have now across the state. And it's everything from political parties to, you know, groups like Citizen Action, good government groups, to breast cancer awareness groups and breast cancer groups, to environmental organizations, to actually chefs organizations, so Chefs for the Marcellus is an organization with Bill Telepan from the Telepan restaurant and several other, you know, top-notch restaurateurs. And so it's this really diverse coalition that is coming together because it's, you know, one thing for you when you have environmentalists or anti-frackers to, you know, come out and say fracking's bad. But it's a whole other thing when you have 1,000 businesses, you know, get together and come together and say, our businesses will be hurt if you come in and do this practice. So your argument of saying that this is an economic boon isn't a boon for us. And we're the ones that have been here and are the backbone of this economy. And so for you to basically throw us under the bus so these new jokers can come in from out of state, it can basically suck all of the resources and the money out of this state and take it somewhere else, leaving us in ruins and leaving our communities wrecked, is incredulous. And so to have these, you know, various groups coming together and standing together and doing this work is creating a strong momentum towards very, hopefully, powerful change that we're going to be seeing here in the state. So you can say, find the coalition website, nyagainstfracking.org. And then, of course, my organization is unitedforaction.org. And you can get information. I mean, on the end, the United for Action page, you can actually go to see an event that we created, a video of an event called Fraconomics that had
that
Jeanette Barth.
Mm-hmm.
What's that?
I was at that event, and I just want to say it was amazing. It was it's totally worth a watch and a listen. And it will completely debunk the myth that this is going to be an economic boon for anyone but these companies when they sell what they take from our land abroad. So, you know, absolutely, you know, must see. What is how did they get to that?
So it's right there on the homepage of United for Action. Mm-hmm. And so you just go unitedforaction.org.
Mm-hmm.
And you can go ahead and see the videos. They're in like 30-minute segments there on the homepage. There as well, I strongly recommend watching the Simona Perry video lecture as well. She's talking about the you know, the effects of what happens in doing these case studies in the gas fields, and she's entitled it. It's like we're losing our love.
Mm.
So that's some things that folks can do. I mean, we've got, you know, we're at this really critical time here in New York State, and all eyes from around the country and even around the world are watching what happens here. We were the first state in the union to get a moratorium, a deliberate moratorium, that is.
Mm-hmm.
And the horizontal drilling, the state has not been opened up to horizontal drilling yet. From what I understand, there are in the southern tier, which is an idea that's been floated by the governor and by people within the DEC, that they're going to open up 5 counties to do gas drilling. And in those counties now, I understand that there are well pads, that they're laying pipelines, that they're doing everything that they can to try and prepare for when they start getting issued permits. And so we're really coming down to the wire here. In terms of what's happening and gas drilling moving forward. So we're looking at, we think, sometime in this next month to month and a half, that we'll be seeing the latest version of the environmental impact statement and probably some regulations produced along with it, which would then give, I think, a 10 to a 15-day comment period, and of course all sorts of lawsuits and injunctions will be filed, and then I think it'll be in the court system, but it quite possibly we could see permits being issued before the end of the year, which is a terrifying thought. I drove through on the way up to the a grassroots music festival that took place just slightly north of Ithaca a couple weeks back. I drove through the southern tier. And it's just some of the most beautiful country. And, you know, visited with a friend there in Binghamton. And I just, it terrified me to think of what will happen to this gorgeous, pristine country and the health of the people that live there if they start doing gas fracking in that area.
There's no guarantee, once they bring it in, they didn't sign a contract with the people of New York State to say, oh, it will only be up in these few regions where they want it. In fact, it could go from there and spread and spread.
Well, you know, it's funny. That's actually what was actually uncovered in some of those foiled documents from the Environmental Working Group report as well, is that basically there is a commitment from the gas industry that they're going to sue the state to say you can't open up one area and not open up every area.
Right.
And so then, of course, it's going to be an issue of all these home rules and are these temporary or permanent bans that are in place, are those actually going to hold up in a court of law and et cetera, et cetera. And that they could potentially open up a great portion of the state. They could potentially open up the New York City watershed. And, you know, the New York City DEP did a report. They studied this. It's one of the only cumulative impact reports that's actually been created by an independent body. And they concluded, the New York City DEP, Hazen and Sawyer report, concluded that it would be catastrophic for the city of New York if gas fracking was done in or near the watershed. I mean, this is one of those things, it's like, you know, and we have that justification that if it's bad for the Syracuse watershed where they've created a ban, and if it's bad for the New York City watershed where they've created a ban, they've set a precedent and have acknowledged that this is a bad thing to do. It is a damage, inherently damaging practice, that there is no way to do this safely, right? So if it's not good enough for the people or the children of New York City, then how somehow is it acceptable for the people and the children in the Southern Tier? And it's an environmental justice issue. I mean, you go into poor communities and you basically prostitute their area because you can, because they're so desperate financially, and then you just cover up the, you know, the health effects or the health impacts and the thing that happens, and you try and get it done as fast as you can, take the money and run. And then you let government and the communities and everyone else that lives there have to deal with the consequences, pay for the consequences. And so we've actually come to this point now where we realize that we're at this kind of final stage in the game, so to speak. It's not a game. It's unfortunately all too real. So I'm happy to announce that very, very soon, at the end of this month, we will be having, most likely it'll be two events on the same weekend. We're looking at the 25th, 26th, and 27th of August. We'll be having an event in Albany, and it looks like we'll be doing one in New York City with Artists Against Fracking. Don't know exactly
that's
who
Yoko
will be.
Yoko Ono's group.
That's Yoko Ono, Sean Lennon's group. Yep. And, you know, and we'll see if, you know, we'll have maybe Natalie Merchant. I'm not exactly sure who will be coming out, but we've had some nice assistance and support from celebrities. If the folks have not or not familiar with what's going on with Artists Against Fracking, I encourage you to go to their website, artistsagainstfracking.org, I believe. .org doesn't work, it's .com. But they have this immense list of celebrities and artists that are now coming out against hydraulic fracturing. So we'll be teaming up with them, and, you know, organizations like 350.org and other, you know, groups to have this day of action. And at the end of it, we will be presenting Governor Cuomo with a pledge. And it is a pledge of resistance, simply saying that the costs are too high. This has never been proven to be safe. You're not listening to the science. And we will not abide. And, I, you know, I think that the pledge of resistance is one that people are willing to now step up and say, I will not abide while you poison our water. I will not abide while you poison our land. I will not abide while you poison my children for money. I will not abide. And so it's going to be interesting to see how, you know, various activists, I think, interpret this. You know, it's going to be a kind of a peaceful, very strong, peaceful form of protest. And, you know, some activists may interpret it as a very strong call for civil disobedience. You know, some activists will just be sure to be signing on so that they can protect the future. I mean, we've come to this point where we've held rallies. We delivered 200,000 petitions to Governor Cuomo for a ban. They sat on the floor and didn't go anywhere in one of the offices there.
We're coming to the end of our time here, David.
So the things that people can get engaged in is, I would say, sign this pledge. And the pledge will be up on don'tfrackny.org. Again, that website is don'tfrackny.org. We just finalized the wording of the pledge. It'll be up there in the next day or 2 days, and you'll be able to sign on to it, get involved with the events that are going to be happening at the end of this month. We'll have things on the United for Action website, but we're not going to abide by this, and we're taking action. We're continuing to call Cuomo, but we're stepping up our game. We're asking people to sign the pledge, and we want to stop fracking, and this is really the way that we feel we can do it.
Well, I just want to thank you so much for this tremendous work that you and the coalition are doing, David, and thank you so much for updating us here on Connect the Dots. And I want to say to our listeners, don't let with what David is describing here, which is the work of democracy being done by these groups, 200,000 signatures being ignored. This is about democracy. So listeners, don't let others do all the work to protect our democracy on your behalf. Time for you to step up too. Go to the websites David Braun mentioned and take action. You can sign up at my blog, healthjournalistblog.com, or be my friend on Facebook on Connecting the Dots for Health. And come with us next week. We'll be back with another edition of Connect the Dots at 10 a.m. Wednesday on the Progressive Radio Network, as we are every week. And David will also be back with us again. Thank you, David, for all you do.